Yes, it's kind of loud. I guess it's about time to start, huh? Welcome, everybody. We're starting our new round of classes today. That we're going to be studying the Book of Esther in this class. Let's see. The Book of Esther is 10 chapters long. We're probably going to be doing one chapter roughly a class, although the last chapter is only 3 verses, so. Probably won't take that long. And we have 12 class periods. So we'll be finishing up around the end of February. Esther is a pretty simple book. I was talking to Michael a second ago. He's been reading through it too. And pretty easy to understand. The lessons we take from it are fairly straightforward. I'm not saying that there isn't any depth there, but clearly there is. And hopefully that this study will be, one we can explore that depth together and help us all in our walk with God. So, if you get a chance this week sometime, take a moment to look through it, read the book. It doesn't take that long. You can finish it in an hour or less, for you speed readers, maybe 30 minutes. But this class period. We're not going to be jumping right into it. We're going to be doing some historical context and things like that. John is going to be our other teacher in this class. He will be taking Sundays, and I'll be doing Wednesdays. He has also got a little bit of an introduction, I think, for our next class too. So we won't be jumping into it Sunday either. So now, as I was saying, chapter by chapter, 10 chapters, 12 classes. We're maybe a little short on material here. So, last class, Jordan and Rick had an entire testament's worth of material to cram into just a few weeks. And they did a pretty good job at that. They had the big testament. So, we kind of have the opposite problem here. That's why we're going to be going through the book line by line, word by word, going to examine the ancient Hebrew in minute detail. No, we're not going to be doing that. No. But we are going to need your help. So, I know some of you guys in here are talkers. I see y'all out here. Yeah. We're going to need your help. Y'all are going to be our best friends for the next few weeks. So, seriously, though, I do appreciate the depth of wisdom and Bible knowledge we clearly have in here. And I'm looking forward to what you all have to say about it. If you have anything to say, any questions, any ideas, comments, anything to discuss, lay it on us. We've got all the time in the world. So, let's see. You can really think of me as your discussion facilitator. I'm not a teacher. John's a teacher. I'm the assistant to the teacher. So, my job is to get you guys to talk, and that goes for everybody, not just our talkers. So, I really want to hear what you all have to say. Tonight's class, like I said, it's going to be a little bit different. As introduction, you might have noticed our fancy map that looks like it's 100 years old. We'll be using that a little bit. We're going to go through some historical context, the timeline. Some of it's going to be review, just a little bit from Jordan's class. We're going to talk about the world that Esther takes place in. So, I'm not a historian by any means. I'm going to be kind of regurgitating some facts. Again, if anybody has anything to say, jump right in. We'll be happy to let you say whatever you'd like. So, all right, let's get into it. So, Esther is the 17th book in the Old Testament. It is the last book of, when we categorize the Bible, what book is it? What category does it fall in? Book of History. It's the last book of history. Yeah. It comes right after Nehemiah and right before the book of Job. The name Esther itself, what does that name mean? What does that word mean? Anybody have any idea? The scroll? Okay. I haven't heard that, but maybe, again, you know, it may be. It's actually a Persian word, or at least a kind of a, you know, rough approximation of a Persian word, Ishtar. And that in the Persian means star. That's what I got. You know, her Hebrew name was Hadassah. Anybody know what that means? It translates to the myrtle tree. Not the crepe myrtle, but the classic myrtle, kind of a evergreen, shrubby tree. It has pretty white blossoms. It's supposed to smell really good. I wouldn't know. Never seen one. But you may have some meaning, you know, Esther being beautiful and maybe have some connection to her personality. Do we know who the author was? Does anybody want to take a shot at that? No, we don't know. We don't know. There's speculation that the author is actually Mordecai, who is one of the central characters of this book. If we called this the Book of Mordecai, it would probably be okay, because he's as much of a character in it as Esther is. We know that the author was certainly a Persian Jew due to his familiarity with the Persian customs and life at the time. Speculation is it was Mordecai because we know he was an author. There are verses in Esther that make reference to things that he wrote, including his writings in the official records of the kings of Media and Persia. And we see that in chapter 10, verse 2. Dating this book. This book was clearly written after the death of Ahasuerus, who's the king in the story. Chapter 10, verse 2 also implies that the state history of his reign had already been written when Esther was composed. They don't write those until you're no longer the king. So he was dead at that point. And we know from secular contextual history, the other documents, that he was actually assassinated in 465 BC. So we know it had to have been written after that. Scholars also point out the absence of any Greek influence. We know that Alexander the Great pretty much conquered all of Persia in 330 BC. So we know that somewhere between 465 and 330, we were pretty sure that that Esther was written. Most suggest that it was written fairly close to the end of Ahasuerus' reign, maybe within 5 to 15 years, so 460, 450 BC. So, so Esther is kind of a unique book in the fact that, well, does anybody know why? There's something that is not in Esther that is in pretty much every other book of the Bible. Anybody know? God is not mentioned in the book at all. Kind of interesting to be a book of the Bible and not have the central character of the Bible in it whatsoever. Due to this, some stylistic things, a few statements made in the book, some historical discrepancies that have come up over time. There are some scholars that question whether this book should actually even be part of the Bible, if its canonicity is authentic. Some people say it should be considered more of like a historical fiction book, or Jewish propaganda even, or like inspiration for a conquered people. Obviously, I don't think so. I think there's some pretty clear things that point out that it is a canonical book. Probably the most notable is going to be the origin of the Feast of Purim, which comes into play later in the book. It's a thing. It's still celebrated by Jews today. The Feast of Purim? Yeah. It had to have some kind of origin. So we'll keep those kind of questions and stuff in mind as we move through the text. Maybe we can find some answers to them as we go through. Any comments on any of the stuff that I just said? Like I said, this class is a little bit different. I'm just kind of just spitting out facts related to the book. Let's get into a little bit of the timeline involved.
I think you can. I think you can pretty well say that what the people that said that some people question whether it should even be in there.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure it's not the case that God turned around one day and went, "Oh, how'd that get in there? I didn't intend that to be in
there."
So there is a reason it's in there.
There's definitely a reason.
Yeah, that's right.
We're going to explore it here for sure. But there are Bible scholars that say that this isn't an authentic book, and they have their reasons. So we'll get into that. All right, so kind of jumping back a few hundred years, 931 BC, King Solomon dies. Shortly thereafter, the kingdom splits. You all covered this recently, just in the last class. The northern kingdom is so bad that God basically decides they're irredeemable as a nation, and what happens to them? Right. The Assyrians march them off into captivity, never to be seen or heard from again. And the southern kingdom, they don't fare much better. They're still caught up in idolatry. What happens to them? The Babylonians. Yes, right. 586 BC, Jerusalem falls. Many of the Jews are carried off to Babylon and actually spread somewhat over the Babylonian Empire as well. They're under Babylonian captivity for the next 47 years. Where's Babylon? Well, have an idea about it. You can kind of see it in the bold letters here. Yeah, it's modern day Iraq, between the Tigris and Euphrates there. I think Rick, is he here? He's not here. He had he had one of his classes, the distance from Jerusalem to Babylon. I can't remember what he said exactly. It was like 400-500 miles, something like that. It's a long way. And you can see there's not a whole lot between between here, so it's really even further away than it looks. But yeah, they're there for 47 years. During that time, we see the rise of another empire beginning, and it's going to be the Persians. Where are the Persians from? Modern day Iran. Yeah, modern day Iran. They're going to be kind of in this area up here, kind of all around. There's actually two empires there, and I kind of hesitate to say empires. Two groups. There's the Medes and there's the Persians. And the Median government is a little bit more powerful at this time than the Persians. Eventually, a man named Cyrus, who we come to know as Cyrus the Great, he comes out of the mountains somewhere up by the Caspian Sea, and he overthrows the Median government and combines both of those groups to form a really pretty powerful empire. This is as Babylon is starting to fade. And let's see, he actually consolidates here, and then he moves and he starts taking over Asia Minor, which is Turkey, and they build this pretty spectacular empire. And let's see, in 539 BC, they finally move in and they take Babylon. Babylon falls, and the Jews now become subjects of this Medo-Persian empire here. And that empire is humongous. I mean, the Babylonians had all this all the way to Egypt, and now you add all this stuff up on top. It was one of the biggest empires in the world ever. And so now the Jews find themselves subjects of that. Let's see here. So yeah, Cyrus, he ends up dying. Darius, I don't know how you pronounce his name, but he takes the throne next, and he continues these visions of expansion. He wants to grow the empire, and so he decides he's going to move up here, and he's going to take Greece, and he marches an army up there, crosses the sea, and marches on Athens, and they end up on a plain called Marathon. And there's a huge battle there. The Greeks whip him. They lose like 200 guys and kill thousands of his guys. And he flees back across the Aegean. And that the famous story, we all probably all heard it. The Greeks after the battle, you know, they send a runner back to Athens, and he runs 26.2 miles, bursts through the door, and shouts victory, and then falls dead. And that's how we get the Marathon. They slapped a 26.2 sticker on his casket as he they put him in the ground. Darius flees back across. He ends up dying a few years later, and then in 486 BC, Darius' son Ahasuerus, the Ahasuerus in the story, takes the throne. This is the Ahasuerus of Esther. He has another name he's known by, a Greek name. Xerxes. Xerxes the First. He's more commonly known throughout the world as that. So he's actually determined to finish what his father started. He wants to take Greece. He wants to expand the empire. He makes some comments about following in the footsteps of Darius and Cyrus, and making the Persian Empire the greatest that the world will ever know. And so he makes plans to go back to Greece. In 483 BC, he throws this lavish, huge banquet, and he pulls together all his military officials, noblemen, just anybody who's anybody of the kingdom. He brings them there, and it's really a party to kind of drum up some hype for this this invasion, get his people motivated, and begin preparations for the invasion of Greece. And this is actually the very feast we read about in Esther chapter 1, where you'll remember the story, his queen ends up kind of humiliating him at. So we know that she gets deposed, and it kind of sets the whole story of Esther in motion. So these are all corroborated by other, you know, historical documents, things that have been found over the years as actually happening. So another pro in the idea that Esther is actually the real deal. The story is following along with history pretty straightforward for the first few chapters. He deposes Vashti. He begins his preparations. He's building this massive, ends up being a million-man army. It's one of the biggest armies ever assembled. And he's going to Greece. He decides that he is going to build a bridge across the Dardanelles Strait, right here, where the Greece and Turkey almost touch. And he has his people float out hundreds and hundreds of little boats and build a pontoon bridge across this little strait. Why not just sail everybody over in the boats? I don't know. He's an interesting character. We're going to see more about his personality and whatnot soon. But yeah, he really, I think John had told me one time, like, his motivation was he wanted to ride his chariot across the sea from Persia to Greece without getting it wet or something like that. It's just crazy. But the bridge ends up getting messed up a bit. He ends up, I mean, this is an amazing feat. They've built a pontoon bridge out of little boats, and a storm comes up, it gets damaged, and he decides that the builders need to be executed. He chops their head off. These people who've done this marvelous feat of engineering. And then he orders that the sea be lashed with a whip 300 times, like he has control over nature. So that kind of gives you some insight into what kind of guy we're dealing with here. Eventually, they get across the strait. He gets his army over, and he's on the march to Athens, and he's got to go by either coming up and going through inland. It's pretty mountainous. He can either go inland, or he can take the shorter route through the coast, which is what he decides to do. He comes to a place, I forget where it is on the map, but basically it's a narrow pass on the coast where the mountains come in real close. It's impassable except for a very small, narrow way. They called it the Hot Gates, better known as, does anybody know what? This is a place called Thermopylae, and he's met there by 7,000 Greeks, and they plug up the hole in that pass, and the battle begins, and they hold out for days and days, and eventually these Greeks are betrayed by one of their own. He leads the army up on a small mountain pass used by shepherds to get around and get behind the Greek lines. When the Greeks see that they're about to be surrounded, they feel it's hopeless. A number of them tell the rest of the army to flee, get back, save themselves, and 300 Spartans and a few hundred other Greeks stay behind to kind of hold off the Persian army while the rest of the army escapes. And this leads to one of the greatest, the greatest last stand, and I know we're proud of the Alamo and everything here, but this was something else. I mean, 300 guys hold off for a day or two. They hold off a million man army in Thermopylae. It allows the army to escape. It buys time for the city of Athens to be evacuated. They clear out. Xerxes, Ahasuerus, is enraged that his army is stopped by 300 guys. He freaks out. He has the bodies decapitated and does all kinds of heinous stuff. But it does allow the Greeks to get away. He actually has some success after this. He takes over a good portion of Greece. But you can see Greece is way over here, and his empire's seats are all way over here. That's pretty long ways to go. They were kind of expecting that the Greeks would fold up pretty quick, and they didn't. And as it drags on, your supply lines, it's hard to reinforce your troops, it's hard to get them food and whatnot. And eventually the losses start piling up, and he has to abandon his hope for taking Greece. He, like his father, flees back across the Aegean, abandons a bunch of his army there, and I think a lot of them end up getting wiped out. And he flees back across the ocean here, and gets back home. And that pretty much takes us to the second chapter of Esther. He's back. He remembers what he did to the queen. He's probably in a bad mood because he's just, been humiliated on, the global stage. His servants are like, "We got to do something." I mean, this guy, he obviously, look what he did to the bridge guys. I mean, so why don't we find him another wife? So that's kind of where the story picks up right there. That's a 3-year campaign, I believe. So from the time of that grand feast to the time he's finally back, it takes 3 years to go through the Greek campaign, and then the story of Esther really kind of begins. So any comments or questions on that? I know I'm just spitting out a lot of facts here. If anybody has anything to say on that? No? All right. All right. Well, let's talk a little bit about the Persian government, because I think some of the things related to them are actually going to be germane to the story as it comes up. Some interesting things about the Persian government: all citizens It didn't matter where they were from, had pretty much equal rights, regardless of their race or religion or anything like that. In fact, they were allowed to practice their own religions. They were allowed to oftentimes keep their own rulers as long as there were no political uprisings or anything like that, no rebellions. Of course, all the same demands of citizenship were made of them. Everybody paid taxes. Everybody had certain responsibilities of citizens. So, the Persian Empire had three capital cities, actually. Let's see here if we can find them on the map. I think two of them are on here. One was Persepolis, and I don't think it's on here. It's actually somewhere out to the east of the Persian Gulf down there. That was considered the royal seat, so it might be considered the main capital. The next one was Ecbatana, and you can kind of see it up here. It's up here in the mountains. That was the emperor's summer home. That's where they'd go to spend the summers. It was cool up there. It was just pretty pleasant. But got pretty rough in the winter, so they would leave it during the winter and they'd come down here to where our story takes place in Susa, or also known as Shushan. And I think remembering Rick just talk about the distance, Shushan, where Esther and Mordecai are living, is now like 800 miles from Jerusalem. So they're way out there. They might as well be on the other side of the world at that point. This is the winter home, really, of the emperors, and that the government would follow him around, obviously, because he was the law. He would basically make edicts, and wherever he was, that was where the government was. It sits on a pretty fertile valley. There's a little river here called the Chopsis. It feeds into the Tigris River, and so it was apparently a pretty beautiful place, beautiful gardens. Kind of the thing that you'd imagine a fancy Middle Eastern palace from ancient times, that would be Susa. So we'll actually talk more about the layout of the city and the palace and all that in some of the other chapters as it actually describes it in the book. So the emperors ruled via a law called the Law of the Medes and the Persians. Does anybody know anything about that? It had kind of a unique and interesting way of ruling. Basically, the law stated that once a law is passed, never can be changed. That's it. It's the law forever. The emperor himself can't overturn it. We're actually going to see this come into play in the book. It might not necessarily be a bad thing if you have a rational thinking person in charge. You'd expect that anybody with half a mind would say, if this is permanent, we should probably think about this law and see if there's going to be any bad effects from it before we make it. Xerxes is not the most forward-thinking guy. He's very rash, impulsive, and we're going to see even more of that in the book as well. It gets our characters here into quite the situation. The empire itself is actually divided into 21 different areas. They'd call them satrapies. They were overseen by a satrap. The satrap was like the local ruler. He might be a nobleman. He might be one of the conquered people's rulers that they've allowed to stay in power. The emperor also has these inspectors that would travel from satrapy to satrapy, and if they brought back a bad report, he probably got the axe. So you always wanted to be on the emperor's good graces. And so at its height, the Persian Empire spread from all the way to Greece to the Indus River, which would be in, it's like to India, basically. and then all the way down here to Egypt. So it was humongous. And perhaps the Romans were the biggest, I believe. It's one of the top 5 or 10 empires as far as size and population that have ever existed. And we're going to see that our humble characters, Esther and Mordecai, from a conquered people, they come up to rise to the very top, basically, of this one of the most powerful empires ever. So, any comments on any of that? Any questions, concerns? I mean, okay. okay. Well, that's going to be most of our background info on the book. Let's see. I know y'all want to have like a fancy PowerPoint show, but Daniel did preach that sermon Sunday morning, so we're going old school here. So, okay. Well, like I said, kind of early, finishing up here. If y'all have any comments or anything y'all want to hear, want to talk about? Yes, sir.
The Dead Sea Scrolls. Mm-hmm. It, according to what I've read, the book of Esther is not among those different books there, or at least it hasn't been found yet. Which is interesting because all the rest of them are. So just a neat little...
Yeah. That is an interesting thing. I think I had heard that somewhere. I think there's several discrepancies with some of the books that are in there, too. That there are chapters that were added that we don't normally see in our Bibles and in certain books. So kind of just interesting thing to think about. So. Okay, so I know I've just spit out a ton of information here. I promise you our other classes are not going to be this way. We're going to have a lot more discussion. There's going to be a lot more to talk about. But I think it's good to just get a little bit of background info on the book itself. It kind of always helps me to kind of look and see where in the world this is going on. It's not just, you know, most of the rest of the Bible is taking place in a, you know, pretty small area. This is a much grander, wider scale here. So, I know we're wrapping up kind of early here, but that's pretty much all I've got for tonight. Anybody, go ahead.
It does help with Trump because it's not just a local person approaching the mayor.
Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah.
You've presented really heightens the magnitude mm-hmm. of the challenges that the people within the story are faced
yes.
with. Because, like I said, it's not just a local government that they're approaching.
This is the preeminent ruler in the world at the time. It's not just some small country or some, you know, small-scale thing. This is a guy that has millions of people that are under his reign. He can raise million-man armies to march and cross the seas. That's definitely going to be interesting when we get to the story itself and we see what Esther has to actually do, the magnitude of what she has to do to save her people. So, okay. Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Why did they just go over in boats or whatever? It probably has a lot to do with the supply line issue as opposed to moving the army across. It has much more to do, I would imagine, I don't know, in proof.
Again,
But it's probably got something to do with keeping that supply line open to where they get supplies to their troops.
Very likely, very possible. Again, I'm not a historian. I don't know the full facts of it, but that would make sense to me, trying to keep your food and your equipment and more men coming across. Boats are kind of, you know, little boats like that. Notoriously unreliable, so not at least for moving million man armies. Ryan, you had something?
The other thought I would add, and I think you basically have covered it, but number one, the canonicity of the Esther. First, what I look to, when people dispute the canon, there's nothing in Esther that contradicts other scripture, which is very important because you've got the internal consistency of all of God's word. And number two, as you've mentioned, you have consistency with the world history from extra biblical sources. And finally, very important is that the core story in Esther, of course, is Haman wanting to destroy and annihilate all the Jews in Judah, but God always preserves the saved remnant. And of course, from the going back to Genesis 49:10, we're talking about the Messiah coming, prophesied coming to Judah. And so Esther, in saving the Jews, preserved Judah, which preserved that small nation for the coming Messiah.
Yeah. Well said. Well said. All right. Go ahead.
And I think one of the other key points that you made, especially when talking about how short-fused Ahasuerus is, I feel like when we study Esther, sometimes we're pretty quick to judge her about why is she being so timid to go talk to him about this. This is a guy who's taking people's heads off, like, at a whim.
Exactly.
So not knowing what the consequence of that decision is going to be, I think, is a key factor in reading through the book.
Yes, definitely, definitely. Yeah, he went from the top dog to not so much pretty quick. Yeah, she's not the first queen. She's, he's already demonstrated what he'll do to a queen if he doesn't like what she does. So, yeah. All right, well, no further comments. We'll wrap up a little bit earlier today. All right, thank you.
What I know about the